Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Wrestling Coast to Coast and everything else. We have a very special show. Evan is in Boston. We're going to be doing an Adrian Street tribute towards the end because Los Angeles was his very first territory outside of the UK when he was wrestling. We've got so much to talk about with him, and we lost him, total legend. But he was wrestling during the time of the original Kendo Nagasaki, Judo, not Lord, but Judo, Al Hayes, Steve Wright, David Morgan, who came into our territory in Los Angeles, so many others, Jackie, Mr. TV, Paulo, Mick McManus, Billy Robinson. But Evan and I are doing the book on John Tolis I've long wanted to do. Evan is in Boston right now, so we have, of course, Jonathan Schwartz with us, one of our regular co-host family members of the show. He's in Ontario, of all places, for our John Tolis discussion. We've talked to Jeff, I have on various shows. Jeff was my boss in the Los Angeles territory. He was a Renaissance man because he was like doing everything. First, in a longtime historian fan, he ran the very first and best Freddie Blassie fan club with Terry Brote, who later became one of our announcers along with Jimmy Lennon. And then later, John Arizzi and I took over the Blassie fan club from Jeff while I was running the Tolis Brothers International fan club. But Jeff Walton did everything. He was hired to come and work for Mike LaBelle, be his program editor, his PR, director of publicity, what a PR whiz Jeff was, writer, interviewer, on air. He did pretty much everything. He was a promoter for at least one of our towns, maybe others besides El Monte. We can get into that. But he knew John, and he and Art Williams, who we'll have on the show in a couple of weeks, hopefully, are the last true 24/7 guys in the Los Angeles LaBelle Hollywood Wrestling office that had, you know, great, great history, decades and decades and decades with genius, we'll call them the matchmakers, Jules Strongbow and Charlie Moto, but many others. But they were, John Tolis would call them the dream team. So let's introduce Jeff Walton, who many of you younger people will may just remember as Tux Newman, managed Andy Kaufman in Memphis for Jerry Jarrett and many others, and had quite the history. His weapon of choice was the cane. He was a very colorful manager. Jeff, let me just ask you off the top, how did that come about? Because our territory, our office closed, and was it just a matter of a couple of months and you went to Memphis?
Well, my wife wanted to throw me out of the house, and she said, you know, why don't you go do something? And I said, okay. I said, maybe I'll go down to some of these other territories. This was when they had the territory system. And I'll send out a video, and I'll become out and, you know, see what I can do in wrestling, because it's very glamorous and you can make a ton of money. Not. And so what happened is I was able to meet Tom Renetto leaving Puerto Rico. He was the matchmaker and booker in Puerto Rico, and he was one of the original assassins. And he was going into the territory that Jerry Jarrett Sr. owned, and it wasn't doing too well. And Hart was just leaving, and they needed a manager in there. So I went in there in January of 85. And started as a manager.
Who were some of the boys that you managed there besides Andy Kaufman, which was a big deal?
The PYT Express, which was I forgot who else now.
Cocoaware. Cocoaware.
Yeah, Norville, yeah, Austin, and Bear. And then Randy Macho Man Savage, I managed him, and we did really, really well. And Iron Mike Sharp, and just everybody you can think of, including Bruiser Brody, who came in and saw me manage Macho Man, and then came up to me in the dressing room. Did a hell of a manager. He says, I'd like you to go out with me and be my manager. And I was very surprised because the guy was a phenomenal talker. And I went out and I managed him. And so I was out almost back and forth. But my kids were little. And so I was there for about 5-6 months. And the money wasn't that great, you know, and I was getting pretty beat up. And not to mention driving almost 3,000 miles a week in my little Buick, you know.
Did you, like Bill Dundee or somebody give you a course of taking bumps? Or because I think you took some bumps there.
I took a lot of bumps. In fact, I'm paying for it now. But it was over time. You know, I worked here in Los Angeles. I got started here and a lot about the business. And that's how I was. And this was the other side of the business. This was the tough side of the business. So I learned a lot in all facets of the wrestling business.
Well, you had that covered in the Los Angeles area.
And I, you know, I did Vince's magazine, Victory Magazine. I started out for him. And
you were the very first editor, right? Yeah. You were the very first editor which became magazine.
Yeah. And that went on for a while until they decided they wanted to do everything out of New York and wanted me to come there and sell my house overnight. Vince McMahon said, Jeff, I need you here in Connecticut tomorrow morning. I want you just to pack up your clothes. And he said, we'll get rid of your house for you. And all this. And I'm listening to this and I can't believe what he's saying. And I thought, joking, but he was serious. And he wanted me to be there by the next day and start to do his magazine and his programs. I was doing his programs for a while too. Madison Square Garden and all the other Boston and all the other programs. And, you know, I thought I'd get rich. And I didn't. But it was wonderful times. It was great.
Rich in experience.
Met a lot of people.
I'll never forget Fred Blassie. I think it was 73 when he came back in. You know, he only came in that year twice. During a two-week period, you know, having the matches with Tolis, who had gone back to being villain again after the thing with Rivera, the hair match that spring with Rivera. And Blassie said on KCOP TV, and you were doing the interview holding the mic up as the stick man, and he said, Jeff, you used to work for me running my fan club, but now I work for you, you know, wrestling in your towns. And it was... it felt very real, and it was, I think people, it's a shame people in New York, they got our Spanish International, our Wednesday TV, Lucha Libre from the Olympic Auditorium in Hispanic towns like Boston, New York City, parts of Florida like Miami, I think Chicago got it, I forget all the towns that got it. I forget what year it started, it might have been early 73, but they didn't get our KCOP where so much cool stuff, the Tolis Blassie Monsel's powder thing that was, I think that I still call it, and I saw all of the Bruno Zabisco stuff, et cetera, Flair Steamboat. But I think it was the greatest angle, in my opinion. I don't know what you think of all time. Fred from the hospital bed, I think he was at St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. That up to that outdoor coliseum where I think the gate and net broke all of Thez's records in California with both Leo Nomolini in Northern California and Baron Michelle Leone in Southern California. That was major, August of 1971. And you were there for all of it. You were right in the office.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a year and a half of planning and plotting and doing all that stuff together. And we had you had very few people, you know, in on what you were doing. And it's not like today. And so it was very interesting as far as the aftermath, as you were saying. Our doctor at the time, and you know who he was, Dr. Schwartz.
Bernard Schwartz.
Hospital in Compton. And so he put Fred in the hospital in Compton. And needless to say, Blassie wasn't too happy about it. So... was like a quick in and out, you know. But that was part of wrestling, you know. You just built everything up. And, you know, we built it to revenge.
But it was very sophisticated. Very well. You had Solis's, or excuse me, all of Fred Blassie's friends, because Fred, once he became babyface, he was over like you can't believe. I would see grown men, kids, everybody crying when Fred was on defensive, you know, going on or getting pummeled and all of that stuff. And obviously, you know, Tolis wasn't part of turning Fred. That was, I think, Sheik, that series, and then the scientific match with Rocky Johnson that cemented Fred as a babyface, the guy of his word. He was just over like nuts. But he had to have his, you know, his equal nemesis in Tolis. And I'll throw to Jonathan because he might know a lot about the Tolis brothers from being an Ontarian, and also Russ. But that Coliseum show, when you look at the matches on there, the undercard, so it had like the two greatest feuds in the planet at the time, Tolis, Blassie, Bobo, and Sheik. And then you had the top feud in Mexico, Mil Máscaras and El Solitario, who died way too young. And the card was insane, top to bottom. Mula against our California women's champion, Betty Nicolai. And they had legit heat for a number of things. Mula was taking credit for breaking the women's barrier in New York State. There was actually Betty Nicolai who did all of that work for 4 years. A lot of people don't know that. So you had all of these elements, and it was, you know, WWE just had their outdoor stadium show yesterday in Detroit. But I think that LA Coliseum show, people still talk about it to this day that we're there, how amazing it was, and all the work and the craft that went into it from yourself, Michael Bell, and everybody, obviously Jules and Charlie Moto. So let me just throw to Jonathan if you've got any questions on the Tolis brothers, because we're basically, Evan and I are going to use this for the book, and we're going to properly quote everybody.
Can I hold this up and see if we can?
Oh, Jonathan, do you have any things you'd like to ask about John and Chris Tolis or their history? That's where they're from, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. It was before they introduced Brett with, you know, city and province and country. They were doing it for John, always from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. The Tolis brothers, starting in the 50s.
Well, that's been a trope for Canadian wrestlers for years. I mean, even post-Bret Hart, Lance Storm used to do Calgary, Alberta, and then pause to get Canada in as well. And I think they still do it pretty much. The only time really much more pronounced when it comes to heels than for faces, they seem to bury Canadian faces, geographic identity, you could say. At one point in WWE particularly, they even started taking the Canadian babyface wrestlers and coming up with a U.S. place where they would come from instead. I remember Chris Benoit, for example, would be introduced as coming from Atlanta, Georgia, instead of from Edmonton, Alberta. Or Chris Jericho would be introduced as from Manhasset, New York, which is technically accurate. He was born there, but pretty much anybody who'd followed his career knew him as coming either from Vancouver when he was in WCW, or being introduced as from Winnipeg by the time he got to WWE. One question about the Tolis brothers, especially their run in Los Angeles. I remember them almost exclusively as pretty bloodthirsty heels almost. But I know they had a face run in Los Angeles against Black Gordman and Goliath. And I'm wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about that, mainly because I actually haven't seen the matches or really seen much of the program myself. It's a little bit before my time. But I'm always amazed, same thing as the Tolis and Blassie feud, where you could take somebody who's so well established as a really villainous, dirty heel kind of character, and then turn them face. And I wonder how you manage that, because pretty much every territory where I've ever come across the Tolis, they were absolutely despised.
Yeah, well, the thing is, at that time with Chris, as Mike knows, their sister, who I think had MS or something like that. And John, Chris, hey, come down here for a couple of weeks. Take advantage of the beach and get yourself some rest. You know, you're taking care of our sisters so much, and you need the time. And so that's tremendous. And as baby faces against Gordon and Goliath, they had to be that way because Gordon and Goliath at the time were a very strong team from Mexico. Came in and and they would say they were from New Mexico, and that's what got the heat. The because our last, every time they were Jimmy Lennon, the ring announcer would announce them, he'd say, "From New Mexico," and they all, you know, everybody just booed. That made them instant heels. Whereas at the time, Chris wasn't even known here. And the night he came in, my wife and her husband and sister, they were all in the first row. And I didn't say anything to them. I, you know, and my wife was not smart to the business. She liked wrestling because, but she wasn't smart to it. So all of a sudden, Chris sits right down next to her, and she sees the resemblance between Chris and John, who was going to work that night. I forgot who John was working that night with. It might have been Blassie. I don't think
Kowalski. So. It was Kowalski it was Kowalski the night he took the title from, because 2 weeks before that, Blassie assisted Tolis against Kowalski because the angle that Fred had to go to Japan, but the storyline was that Kowalski broke Fred's leg, and prior to that, and then Fred came to help out of the blue, John against Kowalski, who was our monster heel. I mean, monster. If you saw Raul Mata, his face when Kowalski would come around, he was legit scared of him. And then Chris, I think that was the second big surprise, because John had turned face around October against Black Gordman of 1971. And then he solidified it against guys like Shibuya, and then the Christmas 1971 big show with Baba and Tolis against Shibuya and Saito at the Olympic, where it was almost like a squash match and people went insane for Baba and Tolis. So I think the only time they ever teamed, right in LA at the Olympic. So Tolis was over monster face by that point when Chris joined him, and Jonathan, not really Gordon and Goliath, but it was Killer Kowalski and Kenji Shibuya. They had the America's Tag titles. They were our lead heel tag team, and that's who the Tolis boys were feuding with until Chris and John started feuding with Billy Graham, who debuted the tie-dye in, of all places, Los Angeles. Came down with San Francisco after Stu Hart training, but he was just known as the heartthrob of America or something, with those leather chaps for Shire. When he came down to us, that's when the tie-dye, when he returned to L.A., like March, April of 1972, he had the tie-dye, and John and Chris helped with that.
I think Billy Graham was the spirit of America. It was one of his really early gimmicks, and he absolutely hated it.
Well, Jeff was there when Billy came in with Dr. Jerry Graham in like August of 1970. And well, Jeff, maybe I'll let you tell it, because Billy had jet black hair then. I think Jerry had his hair dyed. He was on his way back. The Sheik had let him go. He drops into Arizona, discovers Billy at some big weight gym, and then the story was that he brought him in, I guess, to team with him. So he was hoping that Mike would give him some work.
That's pretty close to what it was. What happened was that Wayne came in Arizona, went up to the wrestling office, and I just happened to walk into the office, and Charlie Moto's in there, and he's not too happy about Jerry Graham being up there, let alone here's this this Mark that just came in with him. You know, this he's the big guy. He's, you know, Moto says to me, he says, Jeff, sit down, sit down. So I, you know, I'm going to sit down, you know. So then he says, what do you think of this guy? And Jerry Graham's trying to tell him, oh, this guy's going to be a headliner at the Olympic. And our Billy Graham, that's his ring name, and he's going to be like my brother, my youngest brother, and a tag team partner. And Moto says, doesn't say anything. He sits back, he looks at me, and he said, would you take him to your town? And I look at Billy Graham, and I say, yeah, I'll take him to my. I had a little town in El Monte. And I said, you're darn. And I said, how many matches have you had? And he said, one in Arizona. And I said, well, can you work? I mean, and he said, well, he says, try me and see. Because he was dying to get in with us. And so I. Forget this. He came up before the match. And goes, what do I do? What do I do? You could see he was really nervous. He was really nervous. And I said, well, you know how to do a bear hug? And he says, yeah. I said, well, he bounce off you a whole bit. And then you take him, throw him in the ropes, let him come off at you, and bear hug him and hold him there. And that's what we did. And then I had the police that were working for me in the town jump up into the ring. So we'd break his, you know, break the hole, bear the guy down. That's what we did for a lot of weeks. And finally, I told Moto, I said, Charlie, I said, you should use this guy. He's learning quickly. And he did.
So, Jeff, by the way, this is Russ, the other guy who runs the show.
Talk.
Here. Yeah. What? Yes.
We
went a record 22 minutes without Mike letting me have a chance to say something. So that you heard it here first in 176 okay. shows. It took me 22
Jeff
minutes.
Was asking for payday. I guess that was it.
So, Jeff, I myself was also a manager, kind of like Andy Kaufman. Was and I he was one of my major inspirational persons that brought me into managing, but I also took a lot of bumps too, like you have, and I kind of wanted to ask you about how that wrestling made the transition, because the early managers that you saw, like the Grand Wizard and so forth, didn't take a lot of bumps. I don't think the Grand Wizard ever took any kind of bumps at all. And then it started getting to a point where managers got to be very physical, and they were taking sometimes as much punishment as the wrestlers were. And what made that transition in wrestling? Because you were kind of there at that time. What do you think made that transition?
You know, that's a real good question. Years ago, like some managers, like Wild Red Berry, who managed the Fabulous Kangaroos, he was a former wrestler, so he knew how to take bumps. And he did take bumps for the Kangaroos and do all that stuff. And he was a little guy. You know, he really wasn't a wrestler. He wasn't. He was a mouth guy, you know, like Paulie Dangerously, really. And at that time, you really didn't. You know, land on guys or land on. Or do all the crazy things they're doing today, you know. That's the trouble with today, and can't work the towns that years ago these wrestlers like Blassie, Tolis, they could do it every night. They could do it standing on their head because they knew how to work with each other and they didn't hurt each other or they didn't hurt themselves. And a lot of these guys to get over today, that's what they do. I'm going off the mark here. Again, with the managers, it just developed to where managers got younger, like yourself, and they were able to do the. They The audience would pop if they got kicked or punched or fell out of the ring or whatever. It was, you know, like a high spot. You know, and I think that that just developed over time. That's what she, you know, more and more of that. And I don't subscribe to that. It's not necessary. The manager should be the mouthpiece. The manager should go on television and really publicize the hell out of the match and his team or his man or his gal, whoever's doing it. And that should be it. It really shouldn't. And then, of course, the match, if there's a finish involved where the manager has to get in on it, if he's got a tennis racket like Cornette or he's got a cane like me to where I use my cane.
I had a palm pilot.
A palm pilot's even better. Get out there and do this, for peace sakes. Anyway.
Jeff froze that's there. Russ's work name was Tello when he was doing his thing in APW and a bunch of promotions, including one he, I think, co-ran California Championship Wrestling. Was that the name, Russ?
Right up there.
Yeah, CCW. Which I think was also the name of Carl Lauer's late 80s thing, where John Tolis managed Professor Toru Tanaka and I think some other talents. In fact, I have so many people that have quotes on John Tolis. I think John managed Don Morocco, who said he was one of the biggest, world's biggest, Bobo Brazil and John Tolis marks. John had that much love and respect. And Jonathan, one thing, or no, Russ. Bernie Roth, as he manages Mr. Clean and Abdul Farouk the Weasel, later the Grand Wizard. But when the Tolis brothers, and Jeff, was this your town when the Tolis brothers took on Sheik and his manager Abdul Farouk, and he had to put on this full body suit? It was like old school 1972 workout gear. You know, and he got in at the very end and I think got killed. That's the only time he got in the match, was at the end and got killed. And so the popular Tolis brothers went over. But I think that was Almonte, wasn't it? Or San Bernardino, one of the two.
Well, there's a bunch of old photographs of working as Abdul Farouk, him in matching camel tights and the curved boots, working alongside the Sheik.
Who?
Because he was up there. I still think he was. I loved him as Sheik's manager, particularly when Abdul Farouk would square off with John and Chris on the mic. That was magic in 72. There was so much going on in L.A. And we had the greatest heels in the business then. Kowalski, our monster heel, then Billy Graham, Ernie Ladd, who came in and ignited that feud with Tolis, where Tolis took off X amount of months. Let me ask Jeff, though, because Evan's going to want me to ask these questions. John, from about 72 on, would take a few months off. And I know he said he went up to, so I wanted to see what your take and thoughts were, you know, particularly on John the Man. But he would take off and go up to Hamilton and help out Chris with the sister. And then he wanted to visit his friends. So he said that he worked in Houston for Paul Bosch. So you can see Paul and Red Bastien and Jose Lothario and Wild McDaniel and Johnny Valentine. Did some spots in Dallas for Fritz and also in Vancouver for Sander Kovacs, particularly to see his longtime life brothers, Gene Kaniski and Don Leo Jonathan. But Jeff, what was your understanding when John would take a little bit of time off? You know, like he did that in 73 and then 74 again.
Well, you know, there were a lot of reasons. The main reason is the one you said, is the sister. They, you know, Chris would take some time and be with her. And we're talking, be at her place and be able to take care of her. And they were a very close family. And mainly that was his reason. The other time, sometimes, personal reasons, you know, he would go away with his wife. His wife wanted him to be, with her more. And eventually it led to their breakup. And there's a lot of reasons, but you know, it's good. He just took off like a rocket. So after a while, you know, and John was always fair. He was always good about this. You know, he was temperamental, and if you caught him at a wrong time, watch out. You know, but in most cases. He was nice enough to where he would say, look, in August, I've got to take a month off. I've got to go up back to Canada, or like you say, make some other dates. There. And Mike, and well, what are you going to do? Like today with Vince McMahon, are you going to go work for Vern Gagne, and are you going to do jobs for Vern Gagne? Or, you know, There was a time when Roy Shire would ask for certain guys and beat our guys, you know, and Mike just didn't have the guts to say, Shire, you know, take a hike. You're not taking Mil Máscaras, and you're not going to beat Mil Máscaras, because that's what he did. And so to a big degree, Mike, you know, that was the only guy he was afraid of, really, was Shire, because he didn't want Shire to come down and start another with us, you know, that we had in the late 50s and early 60s.
Yeah, because he did an aggressive takeover of Northern California over Joe Malkiewicz, but he also, for a little while, tried taking over Hawaii, and there was a territory war with him and Ed Francis, with Lord Blair obviously in the office with Ed Francis, who quickly won out. You know, similar to the Bern Gagne thing. And what year was that, 68, 69? The Save Our Sports, whole, that was a very short sports, but huge territory war. All that talent, Russ, coming into LA.
I'm sorry, to answer your question, it's just a matter of how wrestling is evolving. Yet or whatever, and it wasn't like that when it was strictly what they called a stick man or a pitch man, you know, getting the matches and the show over that wasn't televised, and that's basically it. And today it's done left and right. Say I don't subscribe to it myself. That's all I can say.
Jeff, let me ask you quickly about Tolis. You said he had a lot of facets to him. He could be, you know, moody or, as you said, a little temperamental at times, because he, but also at the same time, he was known as one of the great gentle rib artists, like a Vic and Ted Christie were gentle rib guys. Tolis being so close, who took care of Vic and Ted. And later Lord Blair's too, when he was in that nursing home, John went and visited him regularly with Gene LaBelle. And also Gene LaBelle and Tolis took great care of Count Billy Varga towards the end, you know, so you saw that real sweet, nurturing part of John. But he also was a jokester, and I wanted to see if, you know, because I really wasn't downstairs in the dressing room. That was before the Needlemans took over the Olympic dressing room. You had to go down the stairs. It kind of faced the parking lot, so they could go right in and go down there. But do you remember, like, John's ribs or practical jokes or any memories in that regard?
Oh, yeah. Now that we're all guys, I can tell you this story. Terry, who you mentioned before, Brote, who used to do the announcing at the Olympic when Ginny Lennon couldn't make it. Terry was going to get married. So all the wrestlers and myself, we got together. We rented in Los Angeles, and we had a bachelor party for Terry. So John was invited, and Roddy Piper at the time wanted to come, but, you know, I wanted to keep everything, because we had a lot of non-wrestling people there, and the whole thing. And we had a young lady there. Everybody was having a drink or two of Coca-Cola and ginger ale, you know, and feeling no pain. See, you guys get it. And you know, they were kind of being very touchy-feely and the whole thing. And everybody was egging Terry on, you know, with this young lady in the theater. And John is going up and down the movie theater. And he's got a bottle, you know. And he's yelling out, "Well, if you don't want to touch her, I'll do it." And so Terry says, no, it's okay. Oh, it's okay. So Terry starts to kiss her. And so John goes up behind him, takes the bottle, starts whacking him on the rear end, saying, go. That was one of the funny incidents. The other incidents was when Tolis had a mystery box at the Olympic, and everybody wanted to know, weeks, what was in the mystery box? Well, nobody knew what was in the mystery box. And Mike said to me, he says, what are we going to put in the mystery box that's going to mean anything? And I said, well, let me think a minute. And I called home. I said, Mike, I got it. I said, I found a place called Animal Actors. And I said, let me call in the morning and see what we can put in that box. And in the morning I called, and the guy says, I got just the thing for you. I got a 15-foot reticular python that you can fit in that box. And sure enough, we had the guy come out that night, and we called Tolis in, and Tolis says, I said, yeah, I got something for the box. And the guy came in with this particular python wrapped around him, 15 feet. He holds the head out like this, you know, and the tongue, and Tolo steps back and he goes, whoa. He says, yeah, that's great. He says, but will he bite me? And the guy says, no, he won't bite you, but just don't make sudden moves, you know. If you're in there, don't make sudden moves. And who is in the front row that night but Herb Alpert, who was a trumpeter, the Tijuana Brass. That was his group or whatever. And he brought his little kid. So he's sitting down in front, and his little kid's sitting by him. And finally, Tolis was going to work with us. So we found out also that Rocky Johnson was scared stiff, peeing his pants, afraid of snakes. So we call Rocky in there because we want to show him the snake. We don't want to drive him. We want to show him the snake. So Rocky comes into the dressing room, and Tolis has the snake out like this to show Rocky. The snake's tongue comes out and almost touches him. And I swear it was like Looney Tunes cartoon. Rocky Johnson's feet start to spin like this, and he runs from one end of the dressing room all the way to the other, which is, of course, under the Olympic auditorium. And we started laughing, and Tolis started laughing, and he said, this is the greatest thing. He says, watch what I do in the ring. So sure enough, they get in the ring. They work a few minutes. They do their thing. Finally, Tolis. Johnson, he goes to the box, he opens the box, makes a big deal about it. The people are on their feet, they want to see what's in the box. He pulls out this 15-foot reticular python, and Rocky sees it and runs out of the ring. Herbert runs out of the Olympic and leaves his kid sitting in the front row. And everybody was just screaming and yelling, and he drops the snake on the mat. And the just all over the place, you know, because Nellie's frightened. And that was about it. It really was hilarious.
I'll throw to Russ on this, but that was years and years and years before Jake Roberts. So Tolis did it first with a python. with a snake.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of anything Most else beyond at first at the Olympic. And what year was that? 70, early 71.
Yeah, 72, something like that.
So, Jeff.
So John turned face in December 71 with Gorman and Shibuya. But, and you remember that last angle that led up to the Christmas show in December 71. Shibuya and Saito tore off Flair-like all of Tolis's clothes down to his underpants, which Flair would duplicate years later. No one had done it before Tolis, like with the snake in the surprise box. So, Russ, let me throw to you.
Yeah, Jeff, we never really found out how you actually got started in professional wrestling because Mike got off with his 22-minute question. I didn't get a chance to. We usually start with how you got started in wrestling. We've sort of concreted over that. So I wanted you
to focus on Tolis tonight. So
well, I wanted to find out about Jeff and how he got actually involved in wrestling to begin with.
Well, like everybody, like all of us here, we were fans, right? We started out at fans. You started going to the matches at an arena. I started going to school. And, you know, I just, I really wasn't that interested in wrestling. But my friend Terry, who ended up being our substitute announcer for Jimmy Lynn, He said, come on, this is great. Let's go down there, you know, on a Wednesday night or a Friday night. They had wrestling. And Wednesday was the TV show. And Friday was your off TV show, you know. And Blassie and Tolis were hot. Was not hot. And he was one of the first masked men that had this gimmick, this figure four leg lock. And he said, I'll give $5,000 to anybody, a fan or a wrestler, that could break the figure four leg lock. Nobody could. When he applied it, nobody could break it. And nobody's done it since. I mean, like he did it. And so anyway, back to me, I got interested in it. I started the Freddie Blassie, Worldwide Freddie Blassie Fan Club, and Mike knew about it, and I think Mike was a member, and then I just kept following wrestling, and there was a guy by the name of Jack Disney that worked at the Olympic, and real quick, he was a publicist for wrestling, not boxing, but wrestling. And he was leaving because the LA Herald was on strike, and he went back as the sports editor. And he's talked to Mike LaBelle. He might, because I used to write him and say, your programs aren't too good. You don't really know what you're talking about with the customers, you know. And so he said, talk to Mike, and maybe and I'll talk to him too, and I'll tell him how good you are. Are you looking for a job? And I had just gotten out of college, and I was working for the bus system here. I was just doing nothing, you know, and reporting back. This driver did this. Anyway, so I went down. I met Mike. Mike says, we can't pay you much. We can pay you $10 for this. We can pay you $20 for this. I can give you $150 a week, but you'll be the publicity director for the Olympic Auditorium. Well, that's like a dream come true after you've enjoyed wrestling for about two years and you're young, you know. So I said, okay. So I came to work, and that was just the beginning. And then Mike said, I want you into the wrestling office so that you'll learn more about the business. And in the wrestling office was Jules Strongo, Charlie, Mr. Moto, and whoever else was in there at the time. I don't know if it was Blassie. I think it was Blassie Von Storni, because it was very closed. You could not get into wrestling. I honestly think I'm one of the first people to ever be an outsider come into the business. And of course, at the same time in St. Louis, Larry Matisic was doing it with Sam, both outsiders at the time and coming into a business. And facet of the business. I put up rings. I put up chairs. I refereed. I announced. I took flyers that I had done myself, bags with rocks, and I went around the neighborhoods to where my arena was closed. And I was throwing them out of my car onto people's lawns to get people to come to wrestling. And I finally learned everything there was about wrestling. And when Dick Lane, rest in peace, passed away, Mike put me on TV and his brother Gene, and we started doing television, and I started doing the announcing and calling matches and the holds and all that stuff, and that took a lot of my time. So I was there for 10, 11, 12 hours a day doing all kinds of things to get ready for our big shows that were coming up. And of course, working on the big Coliseum show in the early 70s, it's all in my book that I wrote.
And the name of that book, Jeff, let's let you get in your plugs.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, I have a book. It came out in 2004. And anybody interested in it, it has everything there is to know, not only about me, but about John Tolis, Chris Tolis, Freddie Blassie, all the back stuff, the girls when they came in and they were allowed to wrestle in California, you know, we helped with that. And there's a lot of stuff that's in the book, and it's not a big book, but it's a really good book that talks about Southern California wrestling.
What was the name of it?
It's called Richmond 95171. That's RI95171. That was the telephone number I pitched after I went down the card. I'd say, call Richmond 95171. That's Richmond 95171. Tickets are only $5. Kids, only $3.50. And you can get your tickets by calling right now. Make your reservation for Friday night. And I did that pitch for about a year. They loved it. And, you know, some nights we would just, the switchboard would be loaded with phone calls. And that was a lot of fun going in there and finding it's some nights, you know, but that's the business. You know, that was the business then. So anyway, it's all.
Jeff, the big sign at the Olympic that was always on camera in the crow's nest, RI95171. I forget who ended up with that when Needleman bought it, or maybe the religious church that owns the Olympic Auditorium now. But that was our pantheon. It was built for the Olympic Games. What year was it, 28 or 1932, Jeff, the Olympic Auditorium for the boxing end of the Olympics in LA at that time?
They had indoor bicycles.
Yeah.
That was the biggest thing.
So far.
And then wrestling came in, boxing, then roller games.
So yeah, where would
it have quite a history.
Where would our fans be able to order this book from? Amazon?
They'd be at Scott. Where can they order the book from?
They can order the book through me at scottmwalton@gmail.com.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And that's how they could also get a hold of Jeff if they wanted to get a hold of him through social media.
Yeah, I'm not on social media, and I'll tell you why. Because years was popular, I went on, and I was on social media answering questions from people that said, oh, we remember you, and blah, 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 blah. So believe me, I'm not trying to build myself up, but it just was too much. So I'm not on social media. So if anybody wants to order the book, they can order it through Scott.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here, for being here this week.
Steve, Scott, do you have any other things to plug, or do you guys have charities or causes, anything else? I know it'd be remiss, but in this, Scott, have you got some stuff to plug besides RI9 5171?
No, I think he's, that's our main thing with our book. We're just two books.
And I'm sure you might have some stuff on Adrian Street, because we're also dedicating the show. We lost Adrian Street about a week ago. He really took the Gorgeous George character to the nth level. And so L.A., when he left the United Kingdom, London, after wrestling there, after growing up, as he said, as a mark for Don Leo Jonathan, who in, I think, 2006 finally married, because they were never married, he and Linda, and Don Leo Jonathan, Adrian Street's favorite wrestler, got a marriage license just to do that for him as a surprise. And it was a huge deal. I was there taking the pictures. Adrian cried throughout. But Adrian, his first territory, ours, with then Judo Chris Adams, before Adrian Street went on to Memphis and Florida for Eddie Graham. Jonathan, I can't remember where else. Adrian Street must have worked other territories.
He worked Tennessee when I went there. He was there already. And he settled in Pensacola, Florida, where he was living until recently. And then they moved back to England. And that's where he passed away, I think, in England. Well, but Adrian he wasn't a big guy, but he knew how to wrestle. And he worked, like you said, with Jackie Paolo, and he even worked with
we worked with Billy Scott Robinson and the big guys.
Yeah, and Adrian and Linda were inseparable. You know, she was very, very quiet lady, you know, and she got into the ring, she could wrestle too. And they made a very nice team, and they did very well while they were here in the States. He didn't want to go back because of the tax situation at the time. And if he did go back, he'd have to pay a lot.
And Jeff, he was one of the world's foremost Ferris wheel and carousel amusement park fixer-uppers. He collected, he had a gigantic backyard that I was at once only. But he had all of these Ferris wheels, and he not only collected them, but he would repair them for amusement parks, you know, when he kind of retired from the ring. It was kind of insane. He was one of the world's experts. So I was going to mention that when Scott was on Busted Open show, the big Sirius XM show. Jonathan, any other memories of either John Tolis or Adrian Street?
Well, I'll stick with Adrian Street just because he did pass away last week. Really an incredible performer, and I know a lot of people have used the term trailblazer relative to him before, but I think he's there as well. I think on both in terms of the character that he created, coming from relative poverty in Wales, he was set to be a third generation coal miner in Wales, bad relationship with his father, who fully expected him to make his own life in the mines, decided that wasn't the path that he wanted to do. So from the age of 14, he headed down to the snake pit and was trained in wrestling, wasn't smartened up to the business until a couple of years after his debut back in 1957. So to give you an idea of how long he was a fixture on the scene, wrestled from 1957 regularly until about 2014, give or take. Incredible career, really kind of brought in kind of a glam rock sensibility, borrowed from Gorgeous George. His first ring name was actually taken in tribute to Don Leo Jonathan. He started off as Kid Tarzan Jonathan, of all things, as an homage to Don Leo Jonathan, who, if you think about it, was this giant of a man with the Mormon spin finisher. And here you have a guy who was about, depending on who you ask, between 5'3" and 5'6", wore 3-inch lifts in his boots, wore the feathers in his hair to kind of make himself look a little bit bigger with all of the outrageous costumes. Also worth noting, the man was a cottage industry unto himself. I mean, he came out with 3 different record albums, 7 different books to his name, ran Skull Crusher's wrestling school in Pensacola, where he trained a whole generation. The exotic Adrian Street gimmick, some would argue, was borrowed, since All Property is Theft in Wrestling by Adrian Adonis when he had his adorable Adrian persona in WWF, and Exotic Adrian was not a fan. Also worth noting, one of the interesting things about his character is that he basically played to any number of really, you know, today very politically incorrect stereotypes about the LGBTQ community. But when he was doing it, he always kind of walked a line where it was more kind of ambiguous. He never actually kind of came out, so to speak, which is something that Adrian Adonis, Goldust, subsequent characters, in order to really establish them as heels, they would basically lean into that more directly. And if they were going to turn face, Goldust in particular, the way they would turn him face would be to say, no, I'm not gay. Adrian never kind of addressed that directly, and he was asked about it. And at one point, his response was, well, if I tell you, then the act's over. Really, really interesting person, really interesting as a business. They've tried to go back to that character since, I think, more successfully, somewhat in Goldust, less successfully. I don't know if people remember in the early 2000s, Rico Constantino, who was from California, I believe, had a run on American Gladiators, and they basically tried to position him as the new Adrian Street with the butterfly makeup on his face and the updo hairdo and the sequins and the bright pink tights and everything. And it just didn't work because he didn't have the same magic that Adrian Street did. And you think about kind of the hard circumstances that he came from and how he kind of made himself. If you're a fan of wrestling from the 1980s, WWF style, not necessarily a household name, but the way that I first kind of came across him was in the old Bill Apter magazines. And specifically, and I don't know why, but this one has always stuck with me. I don't know if the guy ever actually existed. I think you all would have a better insight to this than I would. But in the Apter magazines, there used to be Matt Brock's names making news as a column. And Matt Brock, whether he was fictional or real, was this grizzled, old-school wrestling reporter. And there was this one column where he went to hang out with exotic Adrian Street in character and Miss Linda. And he and Matt Brock was completely taken aback by how subservient Miss Linda was, again, kind of full-on story. They asked him if he wanted anything to eat, and the options were sushi or quiche, and just kind of fully playing into the character. And by all accounts, tough as nails, could defend himself, beat the absolute living hell out of Jimmy Savile, who was a BBC kids show host at the time, and it turns out was a very, very, very terrible person out of the ring, but Street certainly got the better of him. And again, really committed to a character that has had an incredible influence over wrestling ever since. And I think he's one guy who really advanced the business of wrestling, speaking as a performer working for himself.
I agree. Okay. I agree with you, Jonathan. And I'll tell you, you want to write a book because you told us. I did know he was a pretty tough guy, though.
You know what? He went to war with Rebel Bill Ash because for a little over 23 years, Adrian Street had his bazaar. It was basically an online and phone-in order. He made tights and boots for the boys for years and years and years while still wrestling, and then once he retired. So that was a big deal. Russ, I better have you close up shop here.
Yeah, well, it was great having you on, Jeff. We'd like to have you on again if you have any other books or any other projects that you have coming on. It's been our pleasure to have you. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining us this week and giving us your input. And, of course, Mike and his 22-minute questions. So we'll see everyone next week. And thank you so much for being on this week. And we'll see everyone again soon. Thank you very much, everyone. Good night.
Thank you, guys.